This podcast is brought to you by ClearBridge Investments. Meet an evolving economy confidently with ClearBridge Active Equities, the foundation of a resilient portfolio. ClearBridge, a Franklin Templeton company. Go to clearbridge.com to learn more.
Please stay tuned for important disclosure information at the conclusion of this episode.
Hi, and welcome to The Long View. I'm Jeff Patak, Chief Ratings Officer at Morningstar Research Services.
And I'm Christine Benz, Director of Personal Finance for Morningstar.
Our guest this week is Eduardo Repetto. Eduardo is Chief Investment Officer of Avantis Investors, where he's responsible for overseeing the research, design, and implementation of the firm's investment strategies. Prior to forming Avantis in 2019, Eduardo was co-CEO, co-CIO, and a director at Dimensional Fund Advisors. Eduardo earned a PhD in aeronautics from the California Institute of Technology and an MSc degree in engineering from Brown University. Eduardo, welcome to The Long View.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me here. It's a pleasure.
Well, it's our pleasure as well. Some of our listeners will be familiar with your background, but not all of them will be. Let's start by discussing your career in investing in finance. What has led you to this point?
Well, I have a kind of weird background. So I was born in Argentina, and then I studied engineering, and then a master in a different engineering, and then a PhD in a different engineering. But then I wanted to do something that had more effect on people. Something you can see in not have to wait 20 years like the research that I was doing during my PhD. And so what I decided is finance is something that all of us touch. Okay? Finance touches our life, our family's life. And so I said, I want to work in finance. And I was lucky enough to be able to move from research in material science, in mathematics, things that I was doing into finance. So I started working at DFA. I started in research, and then over time I became CIO and then co-CEO, and I've been involved with many, many different financial projects. And now, after retiring from Dimensional, I started a new venture. It's called Avantis, Avantis Investors. And, you know, I cannot be more thankful about all the people that are interacting with finance, because I learned from all of them. And finance really matters, and it matters for all the investors, for all the people saving for retirement, for their kids' weddings, for the kids' education. It's just a beautiful field to work in because you can help people.
When you entered investment management, you were not formally trained for it, as you said. For instance, you didn't come out of business school or have a CFA charter in hand. Did you find that beneficial insofar as you didn't bring ingrained habits or hardened thinking along with you and could look at things with a fresh set of eyes?
I think that would be unfair. You know, if some people come with a great backgrounds and, you know, they build on their backgrounds and do quite a lot of good things in the industry. Mine was different. You know, I was more trained in typical science, let's say hard sciences. Think about mathematics, computer science, engineering, and I had a PhD from Caltech in aeronautical engineering. So, yes, I didn't have much of the background that people come from an MBA school. But I was looking already at finance because it was something very intriguing. A friend of mine, a former boss of mine, have a PhD in mathematics from Caltech, and he moved to finance. And he was telling me all the time, say, hey, you will like finance because similar mathematical concepts apply in a different way. And you can apply the logics and all the things that you do when you're doing research. You can apply to finance, to marketing, to running a company. And he was right. So when I started, I didn't know as much as probably someone come from an MBA, but I have a very good training in learning, because when you have a PhD from Caltech, you basically, you learn things quite fast and quite in depth. That's why, you know, it's the top school. And so I was able to learn a lot of things over time on my own, but also interacting with great individuals like Professors Farman, French, Merton, Myron Scholes, you know, great minds in finance. And by interacting with them, working with them, I was able to learn concepts that probably you cannot learn in regular courses, much in depth. And so I was lucky. You know, you need to put effort, but you also need to be lucky. And I put the effort, but I also recognized I was lucky in learning all these things.
Maybe shifting to Avantis, which you mentioned before you joined up with Avantis, you probably had time to reflect after you left Dimensional. Did you consider doing something other than leading an investment organization?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, I was at PFA for more than 17 years, but I needed to leave. And why? Because my office was in Texas, the clients and employees were all around the world, and my family lives in Los Angeles. And so I have a conflict there, and I needed to solve it. So I basically resigned without any plan. I resigned and I spent time off, you know, taking my kids to school, something that I have not done in the case of my youngest son. And so it's time off to think what you want to do. And my wife was thinking, ideas, why you don't do this, why you don't do that? And you always have people offering you to work, running a company or doing other things. But nothing was clicking, to be fair, until some people from American Century reach out and say, hey, are you interested in helping us build an asset management with these concepts? And the concepts were very, very interesting because they wanted to build an offering based on financial science at low expense ratios. And so it was really, really appealing because it can make a difference to the end investor. And that clicked with me. And so I said, oh, this is interesting. We can create something from scratch, bring a whole culture of service to the end client, apply the cutting edge research and new technologies. And so this was really more appealing than anything else that I was hearing at the time. And that's why we started Novartis inside American Century.
This is the first time that you've had an opportunity to forge a company's culture and identity from scratch. What were your key priorities in doing so, and how has that informed decisions that you've made in setting up Avantis?
Yeah, I think you are right speaking about culture, because culture is really, really important in a company. You want a company that has the fighting spirit and tries to win, but at the same time, winning is not something that you do if you don't think about your clients. And our culture is a culture of service to our clients, and that's how we set it up. And we set that culture of service into our clients by how we hire, how we create alignment of interests inside the company, how we create investment strategies and the low expense ratios that we have. And Avantis is a very, very flat organization. It's part of American Century. It's a little bit independent, but it's part of American Century. But inside Avantis, the people with Avantis Business Card, basically it's a flat organization. Everyone has a saying, everyone works. And we have a motto that is, hey, we need to make those clients better off. And we do that by creating good investment strategies, by being humble when we interact with them and trying to learn with them and also keep our knowledge to them. And that's why the alignment of interest is important. Everyone across the company have that spirit. And I think that makes a difference. You know, sometimes, you know, people tend to be a little bit arrogant when they know more than others and whatnot. But in reality, none of us know all the answers for all the possible problems that an investor may have. And so we want to listen to them and then interact with those clients and trying to find, what about this? What about that? We have seen this before. And in that way, not only we provide a service to them, we also learn how to provide the same service to many other people. And that's the culture that we want to have.
In addition to your service ethic, which you just described really well, I think you've also said that you value open interaction, debate, discussion of ideas. Can you talk about what the most active debate on the team is right now? Just to give an example, maybe it's an investment topic, maybe it's pertinent to the way you're running the business. You know, what's a debate that your team is having that, you know, you particularly relish seeing them have?
Yeah, look, every day there is something new. And you can imagine when you have a team like ours, many things are at the same time being spoken by different group of people. And so it can be from communications issues to the possible tax changes that are coming down the road and the effect on products. You know, that's a big one. We don't know where taxes will go and how will affect the whole industry of wealth management and how we can set up our offering, our material, our teachings so people can be prepared for that in case there is a big, big change. But you also think about new strategies. If you think about portfolios, we're going to be launching for a new ETF in the second part of the year. So we are just refining all the details of how they are going to be run, what's the details of the strategies, how people can use them in an asset allocation, because not only think about the product, but how they are going to be used in an asset allocation for the benefit of investors. So, you know, there are many things going on, not one particular one. And sometimes it's not our expertise. Sometimes we reach out to people to bring expertise. For example, on the possible tax changes, we interact with people that are experts on the topics to tell us, hey, how is the effect of this in wealth management? So the debate is not only internal to us. Sometimes it's people coming from outside and helping us with the topics.
When you were there, Dimensional was focused heavily on selling to financial advisors. Avantis is different. You'll sell your products to any market. What have been the biggest lessons for you as you've made that transition to selling to different investor types? And are there choices you've made in building the business that you wouldn't have made if you were focused solely on selling to financial advisors?
This is a great question, because I will make a difference between us selling and people buying. So as you know, we have funds, ETF, and SMAs. So the funds and SMAs, we deal only with financial advisors, and SMAs is separate managed accounts. But in ETF, ETF is a public security. So when you launch an ETF, anyone can buy. And when I say anyone, I literally mean anyone. Because it can be a retail investor from the United States or an advisor for their clients, or it can be from outside the United States. We look at the custody reports and we know that we have clients that come from Europe, from Asia, from Korea, from Australia. So clients from many different places, and we are not selling to them. They find our name because Morningstar or press, or because they happen to know us from the past, but they're buying that. So we are not selling to many different kind of investors, but they are buying. Our selling focus is on wealth management managers, like advisors, consultants, or institutions. So that's where we really focus on selling. And why we do that? Because, you know, we are trying to create investment solutions that fits asset allocation. So we really want to deal with people that are thinking on asset allocation and give them enough information about what we do, so they can use our investment solutions, no matter if it's a fund or ETF or a separate account. They can use it in conjunction with any other investment they have in order to achieve the end investor's goal. So we really are selling to wealth managers, advisors, and institutions, though our clients, because the ETF is a public security, tends to be way broader than that. We receive sometimes emails from any investors, and we are very polite, and we answer, and we provide all the information that is being asked. But we don't have a big marketing campaign with buying a page in the Wall Street Journal or the Financial Times or any other place. So we're not reaching out to the investors. It's a little bit different marketing approach, and, you know, have a little bit sophisticated products. So given that, we think that we're better off speaking directly to professional investors, that they will understand all what we say extremely well.
We're going to shift gears and talk about markets and factor investing in a bit. But before we did that, we wanted to get your perspective on a few other topics that are pertinent to business strategy and in the investment management business. And one of those is advice. One of the things that we've seen is in the public investments business, funds and ETFs, it's going through a sea change with passive taking share from active and costs looming large and how funds are chosen. The advice business, though, hasn't seen the same degree of change. For instance, it's still pretty common for advisors to charge clients 1% of assets. Do you expect that to change? And what are the implications for a firm like yours as the advice business comes to experience the kind of price pressure that is now familiar within the fund and ETF business?
Yeah, Jeff, you're absolutely right. You know, the asset management business, you know, the fees have been going down. And it has been going down because the fees have been going down, but also because people have moved their assets from high-fee products to low-fee products. And so that is seen everywhere. When you speak about advisory business, wealth management, one thing that you see is that the business has evolved a little bit from just being asset allocation to be a more comprehensive service that people receive. Like, you know, people integrate the investments with the taxes, with the wealth planning, wealth transfer across generations. So the business, you know, the services that advisors are providing are broader than just the typical asset allocation. And for example, I have an advice, and you say, Eduardo, why do you want an advice? You should know how to do an asset allocation. And I would say, yeah, I know how to do an asset allocation. But in reality, I don't know enough about how to set up trust, how to integrate that with my taxes. So the advice business is more than just an asset allocation. And advisors are providing a broader set of tools than just an asset allocation today. Now, fees, you are right. If you go back in time, the 1% was the typical number. But today you have different advisors providing different services at different level of fees. You have from advisors providing a flat fee, so it's just a dollar number, to advisors providing an hourly number, and advisors providing a 1% or lower percentages depending on how much money people have working with that advisor. So the beauty of that is that you have a whole set of advisors with a lot of different services, and the end investor can select. The end investor can pick one that provides certain services and given fees, or someone that provides different services at lower fees, or they can be just doing the investments on their own. I'm a big believer in the market. And what I mean by that is you have full disclosures of all these services and all these fees. People select what's best for them based on what they need. And the price that we have out there today, it's really good. It's not that everyone is the same. And probably you are seeing the same, but that's what I'm seeing.
Some are arguing that technology will usher out packaged products like ETFs and funds in favor of personalized solutions, direct indexing, custom indexing. What's your take on this? And is this a possibility you're preparing for as a firm? Is it something that you've talked about?
You know, it's very, very interesting because direct investments or model delivery portfolios or separate accounts really provide a tool for investors that have very particular needs. Like, imagine that you have certain set of constraints that no one else has. So I don't want to invest in this kind of companies because some personal family issue. Let's put to that extreme. And if that's the case, you know, you buy an ETF or you buy a mutual fund, you probably will not find a mutual fund that has these considerations that you have in mind. You know, a mutual fund is created, or an ETF is created for many people at the same time, and your particular considerations are not going to be included in that strategy in general, unless if you share those with everyone else, then it's not personal. And so a separate account, basically, or direct indexing, probably allows you to have these very particular considerations in your investments. Now, it's true that costs have gone down dramatically, so people can have even fractional shares today, so very low amount of money, have a fully diversified portfolio with a lot of names because you don't even have to buy a share. You can buy a fraction of a share nowadays. So that's also something I'm telling you, wow, holding individual securities is probably going to become big in the future. On the other side, when you have an SMA or you have a direct indexing, you don't have the tax advantages of an ETF. So you know that ETF have big tax advantages, and ETF is able to rebalance inside the ETF structure and shield shareholders from big capital gains distributions. That you cannot do that when you hold individual securities, because whenever you want to rebalance that portfolio, you are selling that security and then you're realizing the capital gains. So ETF provide benefits that really you cannot find when you have an SMA or individual securities in a portfolio. So for certain investors, an SMA, separate account, or holding individual securities is the right solution because they really cannot find a commingled strategy in an ETF way that can deliver what they want. So it will be absolutely personalized to them and no one else shares those constraints. Now, on the other side, if you can share the constraints, you're probably better off with an ETF because you achieve probably lower fees, you have better taxation, it's more efficient and better diversified. So again, this depends on who is investor and what do they want. How do we prepare ourselves? Well, we have ETF offering, this magnificent vehicle. You have the numbers, and you know, I look always at Morningstar cash flows, and you can see that ETFs are really winning the battle when compared with mutual funds that were, you know, mutual funds in 1940 technology. ETF is very recent technologies, and the flows are showing what people's preference. So ETF are growing, mutual funds are shrinking. And direct indexing is somewhere in between. It's growing. It has a lot of adepts. And it can help you customize your portfolio in a way that you probably cannot do with an ETF. But it doesn't have the tax advantages that an ETF has. So we have all the offerings. We have a future fund, we have SMAs, we have ETF, and we provide people with the advantages and disadvantages of each one of them. So they can decide based on their personal circumstances which one of the structures will be better for them. And, you know, again, it's like what I was telling you before, is I believe in markets. You provide people information and they can make the best decision well informed.
That's a good segue to our next topic, which is macro. I wanted to ask you about something that you state on the Avantis website, which is, we believe market prices represent an unbiased view of a company's prospects and risks, and that paying lower prices for our share of future cash flows has the potential to produce outperformance versus a benchmark. My question is, until relatively recently, we were seeing a frenzy in things like meme stocks, crypto, NFTs, SPACs, and other speculative assets. How do you reconcile that frenzied behavior with the statement that you make that market prices represent an unbiased view of a company's or an asset's prospects?
Look, this is the classical question. Are markets efficient or not? And what does it mean? So how can it be that some assets are priced this way and because we cannot rationalize sometimes? And it's the link where behavioral finance meet rational markets at the end of the day. And it's beautiful because you price a company applying a discount rate to the future cash flows of the company. And you say, well, something that is more risky should have a higher tax rate. But there is a taste and preference also in that discount rate. If no one likes something, that discount rate will be higher and the price will be lower. And everyone likes something, no? The price will be higher and the discount rate will be lower. And so the discount rate itself has a behavioral component. That's why, you know, you think about finance as a humanistic science. There is a behavioral aspect that affects prices, and that's important. Now, how I link all this, you say, well, the behavioral aspect may be persistent and may be there forever or may change. So you cannot say that because something has a price that you say, well, this price I cannot rationalize. You cannot say that the price may not move in a way that you thought that was going to move. It can be there forever and it can have information that is beyond what we know. This is important because when we're thinking about the price of a company, we're thinking about how is that company being priced? How the market comes to the price? And the market comes to the price by considering risks of the company, opportunities, not only the company, it's all the competitors around the company because they affect the company. Tastes, you know, people taste, you know, you see ESG is becoming bigger and bigger. So there is a taste component of people trying to be investors in a company, preferences of different kinds. And so all this goes together in the price. What we cannot really predict is if the price is going to go up or down tomorrow. Now, what we can do, thanks to financial science, is saying at this price, this company has long-term expected returns that are high or low, but I'm emphasizing long-term. I cannot tell you when, but I can tell you if the price is too high of a company related to fundamentals, I can tell you that company probably has very low expected returns over a long term. And so that's how we reconcile us that. We recognize the behavioral aspects that push prices up and down, but we cannot provide a timing on when these things will correct, if you want to think about that, to a different level. But what we can tell you, at this price level, the long-term expected returns of this company is high or low. And that's information that we use. We use that price together with a lot of fundamentals to say, this company is attractive from long-term expected return point of view. And that's how we reconcile, and that's how we use information. And you mentioned SPACs, for example. At the given price, you know, buying those SPACs is certainly not a good long-term investment. We cannot tell you when the correction happened. In this case, we can after the fact. But we know if we're going to deploy money thinking long term, that's probably not the right place to put it.
Retirees are having to wrestle with high valuations and very low yields today. What advice do you have for those who are trying to maintain their standards of living through retirement while fending with these issues?
Look, this is a very tough point. A lot of people have been thinking about retirees. And there is a concept that is very, very important that probably we haven't emphasized enough in the past. What is the risk-free asset when you are saving for retirement? You know, many people think that an asset has low risk is short-term bonds, short-term treasuries. But when you're saving for retirement, it's way more risky to invest in short-term treasuries than to invest in long-term treasuries, because long-term treasuries are less risky if you think about the variability of the cash flow that you're going to get in the future. And so part of the issue that we're facing today is that people probably didn't have the best asset allocation going back in time. They were focusing on daily volatility by buying short-term debt instead of buying long-term debt to immunize their portfolio when they were at the point of retirement. But now you say, well, too late. Now what do we do? Well, we can do a couple of things. First is recognize the current situation. And second is don't think so much about income. So everyone thinks, what's the income that the portfolio will produce? Because that's what I consume. And I push a little bit back on thinking about income. And I think more about the overall portfolio and the total returns of the overall portfolio. You really don't care if the return that you get comes from income or from capital appreciation. You know, what you care is how much you have to consume. If it comes from a capital appreciation, doesn't make a difference to me. It's probably even better because I pay less in taxes. I pay capital gains taxes instead of income taxes. So one thing that I hope people think today is drop the idea of thinking about income and let's think about the overall asset allocation and the total return of the portfolio as a source for our funding of retirement. And if we do that, I think we are going to be a little better off than if we think just about income, because as you say, income is extremely low today. Think about the last year or the last 2 years. You know, if you think about income, income is very low. But if you think about the market, you know, the market produces good returns and you can live from those returns, even though they're capital appreciation, not income. So it's good to think about overall portfolio, not just the income component.
I wanted to shift and talk about factor investing. The investing principles you follow would probably look familiar to many factor investors. I'm thinking about tilts towards things like small value, quality, emerging markets. Where do you think you break from the factor investing orthodoxy?
This is a very current topic, and it's obvious that you are speaking about this, and this is the current debate of the day. I tell you how I think about factor investing, and in reality, how I think about asset pricing models, because at the end of the day, factor investment is a part of asset pricing models. So if you go back in time, investing was an art. You know, you go grand old, and investment is an art. But over time, you start thinking about Markowitz, Sharp, and all the research that came after, you know, they were trying to put a financial framework, a scientific framework, around that art of investing. And, you know, people start looking at certain securities moving in a given way and say, oh, these securities do better than these others. And that creates the idea of, oh, by looking at these characteristics versus these others, securities perform better. And then we start creating factors like high book to market versus low book to market, like high market cap versus low market cap, like high earnings price versus low earnings price. And all these factors are helping us understand how the market is pricing securities. We are discovering that securities that have certain characteristics have higher expected returns than securities that have different characteristics. But we are doing that one characteristic at a time. And this was the factor framework. And then you have multi-factor framework trying to mix all these factors. But when you mix all these factors, you push in one factor, even without noticing, you are pushing against another. So if you buy high quality, you push against value. You buy value, you get low quality. So if this factor framework is like thinking about the pizza, not as a pizza, but thinking about all the components of the pizza. And if you are a great chef, you think about the components, but in reality, you think about the whole pizza. That's the best chef make a difference beyond the ingredients. And the way we think about this is in a post-factor framework. Just passport framework got up to here. Now we need to think beyond factors. And what do I mean by this? We learn a lot from factors. You know, we learn that certain characteristics matter. How can we think about valuations given everything that we learn about factors? And that's what we do. So we think about the price of the company, and it's a function of what? Well, it has to be a function of how much equity the company has inside. It also has to be a function of the cash flows that the company is generating. And certainly, it's a function of the discount rate, the expected return, because those future cash flows are discounted at some discount rate. So if you think about this valuation framework, it's telling you how to use all these factors together, equity to price, you know, famous book to market if you want to think, profits to price, you think earnings price, profits to equity, return on equity. So it's telling you all the levers and how they interact together at the company level. So then you can say, oh, let's stop thinking about factors. Let's start thinking about the whole company and what characteristics make this company interesting from the expected return point of view. And that's what we do. It's one more step towards systematizing active management to be from the art that was in the past to a fully scientific process that is becoming today and going in the future. And that's where we are. That's what we bring to the table.
Value has had a rough time, but it has surged lately. No one should expect a factor like value to work all the time, but this has been an especially prolonged and painful slump for value. Can you talk about why it happened and how should that experience shape the expectations that investors form about value's long-term payoff?
Look, yes, it has been a long time, but you know, people that study markets, and you guys certainly study markets that have a lot of data, certainly remember that equities underperformed bonds for 18 years in a row. That's a long stretch. So when you're thinking about markets that you have a rational component and a behavioral component, there are excursions. And what do I mean excursions? Sometimes the prices go one direction. And you say, well, it's going beyond fundamentals. How can it be? Yeah. These things happen. And still, the only thing we can do is make decisions based on best expectations. And sometimes it takes a while for these things to recover. Now, when you have been around for a while, you always remember, for example, 1999, 2000. And you remember companies trading at very, very high price. That's much, much higher than the fundamentals. And you say, how can it be? Well, at some point, fundamentals is gravity. You know, there is a gravity pull from fundamentals that bring prices to a more reasonable reality. So if you go back to 2000, you have, you know, all these very high price companies having very high price relative to a book, to earnings, to cash flows, to all the different fundamentals that matter. And what happened after that? Well, those companies have very high price, have very low, even negative, expected returns going forward. And the other asset classes that were priced reasonably did much, much better. And this is what I mean, the excursions. Something just goes beyond fundamentals, but at some point, fundamentals pull them back and things become more rational. And if you look in, you know, you were mentioning up to very recently, still now, we have a very similar situation, what we saw in 2000, with prices of certain companies going way beyond fundamentals. Companies with no earnings trading at very, very high price. So what we can say, this is thing that we're speaking when we're speaking with the Jeff before. No, if the price is very high for something, its expected return is low. We don't know when it's going to change. We cannot tell you if it's tomorrow, next month, 6 months from now. But we can tell you long term, those companies have low expected return. So, you know, it is part of investing. You know, you had to be exposed to this, you know, sometimes unpleasant realities that last a while. But if you do things based on fundamentals and you do things in a scientific way with diversification, focusing on turnover and everything, over the long term, I think that you're going to be okay. We did a little bit of research project and we look at the performance of a small value versus the performance of the market over 20-year windows. And you know, if you go back to 1927, every 20-year window, small value beat the market. Now, inside those 20-year windows, there are many periods, sub-periods, where it didn't go as well for a small value, but it did recover. So, you know, lifetime investment really means thinking about long-term and doing things in a way that is basically based on expectations. And that's what we do.
We had Patrick O'Shaughnessy, who heads up O'Shaughnessy Asset Management, on our podcast recently. And he said his firm, which is also quantitative, doesn't expect small cap stocks to outperform large cap just because they're the stocks of smaller companies. Do you agree with that? And if not, what role should market capitalization play in one's investment process?
You know, if a company is small, just pick any small cap company. No, you cannot tell me that that company has high or low expected returns. This is the thing that we were speaking a minute ago. If you have a company that is small cap and the price is very, very high relative to fundamentals, that company will not have high expected returns. That company will have low expected returns. So by being a small cap, you certainly not assure high expected returns. Valuations matter. Valuations matter in large cap, valuations matter in small caps. And there are many, many small cap companies that are trading at a very, very high price. And so you can expect high expected returns from them. So I don't think that you can say, I'm going to have higher performance because I buy small cap companies. I don't think there is any fundamental issue there, any fundamental theory, anything that will say small cap companies should outperform because they are just small caps. Now, what is the role of market capitalization? And that's a very important question because market capitalization plays a role. What is the role? If you look at the premiums, think about the expected performance of one set of companies versus the other, for example, performance of value companies minus growth companies. If you look at the premiums in large caps, so a large value minus a large growth company, the premium in large cap, the difference in expected returns among companies in large cap is smaller than the premiums in a small cap. A small cap has everything magnified. So the best performers are way more better performers than in large cap, and the worst performers are very, very worse performance than in large cap. So small caps magnify the premiums. So how can you use that information to add value to the portfolio? Well, the way to add information, hey, I want to create a portfolio that has higher performance. How can I do that? Well, I can search for companies in large cap that are expected to outperform, and I will get some outperformance. Or I can do the same in small caps, where the outperformance is expected to be much, much higher. And so, you know, if you are caring about performance, small caps give you broader opportunities. So the way we think about small caps is, hey, if you want to look for high expected returns, large caps provide opportunities, but the small cap provide much more of an opportunity set than what you can find in large caps.
You widely diversify the portfolios you manage and don't trade a lot. In explaining that in the past, we've heard you say costs are certain, but expected returns are not. Can you expand on that reasoning?
Yeah, look, wow, you take notes of everything in the past. So yes, expected returns are very, very interesting. They're expected. That means that you think that it will happen, but it's absolutely not sure. So if I'm going to incur $1 in cost today to earn a dollar tomorrow in expectations, you're saying, you're crazy because you're spending $1 today and that dollar that you're going to earn tomorrow, first, is tomorrow and second, is an expectation. So may or may not happen. So costs matter in the sense that it's certain you spend it today with expectation of having some benefit tomorrow. So the the benefit that you're expecting tomorrow has to be meaningfully higher than the cost, because there is a risk about that benefit tomorrow. It's not certain at all. So if you have a portfolio that has very high turnover, you're incurring a lot of costs. How many great opportunities you are having tomorrow that basically gives you any kind of warranty that it's good to spend all that money today with that hope of making money tomorrow? It's better to be very, very conscious across costs today and just focus on the great opportunities of tomorrow. So there is a meaningful benefit, not a marginal benefit. Because for a marginal benefit, probably your trade-off after the fact will not be positive. You will have spent way more money than the realized benefits. And so we really focus on turnover. We really focus on cost because we recognize the uncertainty of the future. And whenever we trade, we do it in a way that we really believe that the benefits of tomorrow are much, much higher than the cost that we incur today.
I wanted to shift gears. You've engaged several big name academics, Hal Hirschfeld, Suzanne Shum, Meyer Statman, as consultants to your firm. They focus more on behavioral finance and advice, whereas your firm's focus is clearly on investing. What do you think is a good model for determining when to outsource? In this case, you're doing it to academic researchers versus building up the expertise in-house and offering it to clients.
Look, we work with Hal, Susan, Meyer Statman, as you mentioned, but also with Sunil Wahal and Andrew Caroli. And so the last two on the rational markets, let's say, are surprising. The previous three more on the behavioral aspects. And both things matter. I remember we were speaking a minute ago about the SPACs and prices and say, hey, behavioral and rational markets meet at some point because there is a humanistic determination of the discount rate. Everything matters. And there are two different points of view, but at some point they converge together. So we try to work with anyone that we think that is an expert and will add value to our clients and us. And so we engage with many, many people. And the goal is to learn and to help our clients learn from them and for them to get feedback from real life investors that are facing problems now or they're trying to solve problems in the future. And so everyone wins in this kind of environment where you can have these open discussions and everyone contributes with a problem, with a solution, with an alternative, or just with ideas. And so how we decide what to outsource or not, in reality, we discuss many things with many people. And it's not that we need to be the ones bringing the idea first. Sometimes we are not the first to bring the idea. Maybe a client tells us, hey, what about this? And then we start working on that, or we ask an academic, have you heard about this before? Has anyone been thinking about the problem of this before? So we try to socialize ideas across clients, our own team, our academic friends, and try to see what bubbles from there. What's the best outcome? Because, you know, sometimes the best outcomes is things that it's a combination of the ideas of everyone else, and that's what we want. We want everyone just to bring something to the table. And the different backgrounds of the different academics is great, because if they were exactly the same, you know, one will replace all of them. But if everyone has different views, it's a more rich environment, more diverse environment, and everyone has a different point of view to bring to the table, and we appreciate that a lot.
As someone who has spent a lot of time reviewing academic research, what are the things that make a paper compelling and practical? And what's the method that you've used to separate the wheat from the chaff?
That's a tough question. So I personally like papers that have not only empirical data, have some theoretical or some good reason why that empirical data, you know, is showing advantages in the tables published by the paper. And why I say that, you know, it's easy to get confused when you're looking at empirical data on something that may have happened in the past, but may not happen in the future. So a pattern in the past. Like if, you know, if you were trying to find payphones, you know, you say, well, airports have payphones because in historical data, every airport has a payphone. Well, I don't know if airports have payphones anymore. So the historical pattern in the past doesn't need to continue in the future. And a theoretical framework gives you the assurance that the past will extend to the future. So I really like papers that have some theoretical or very logical reason why something that you see in the past will continue in the future, because we invest the money for the future. The past is just a guidance to how we do things better going forward. And so if you give me a paper that just has numbers and the logic is not sound of why those numbers are there, I personally will not like that paper too much. I would like a paper that gives me a reason why I see something in the past and why that will continue in the future. And there are great papers about that. And sometimes the logic in the paper is not there, but you can find a logic by the process of discussing with people or just thinking about it on your own. And so I really care about papers that make a difference going forward and not just the paper that show me something that happens, even though they don't say it may have happened randomly in the past. I also like papers that are implementable. So if you have something that is implementable, I like it a lot, way more than something that is not implementable. You know, there are things that you say, I see a dollar flying in the sky. Can I grab it? Not really, because it's flying in the sky and I can't reach it. So why does that matter to me? It's interesting, but doesn't matter to me. So I really think like things that are implementable, because that make a difference for our clients and us. And so that's the second layer of things that I will look at in the paper.
Well, Eduardo, this has been a very enlightening discussion. Thanks so much for joining us and sharing your insights. We really appreciate it.
Oh, it's a pleasure, please. Thank you very much for having me, and I really appreciate everything that you guys do.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for joining us in The Long View. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe to and rate The Long View from Morningstar on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow us on Twitter at SYouth1, which is SYOUTH and the number one.
And at Christine_Benz.
George Cassidy is our engineer for the podcast, and Carrie Gretchick produces the show notes each week. Finally, we'd love to get your feedback. If you have a comment or a guest idea, please email us at thelongview@morningstar.com. Until next time, thanks for joining us.
This recording is for informational purposes only and should not be considered investment advice. Opinions expressed are as of the date of recording. Such opinions are subject to change. The views and opinions of guests on this program are not necessarily those of Morningstar Inc. and its affiliates. Morningstar and its affiliates are not affiliated with this guest or his or her business affiliates unless otherwise stated. Morningstar does not guarantee the accuracy or the completeness of the data presented herein. Jeff Patak is an employee of Morningstar Research Services, LLC. Morningstar Research Services is a subsidiary of Morningstar Inc. and is registered with and governed by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Morningstar Research Services shall not be responsible for any trading decisions, damages, or other losses resulting from or related to the information, data analyses, or opinions, or their use. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. All investments are subject to investment risk, including possible loss of principal. Individuals should seriously consider if an investment is suitable for them by referencing their own financial position, investment objectives, and risk profile before making any investment decision.